keeping a lookout for any act or word that hinted of criticism or hostility. Though I desired to make it clear that the crew and I were on different levels, I found myself spending more and more time in their company. In truth, I had endless questions to ask as to what this was and what was that. They, in turn, found in me a naive but eager recipient for their answers. Then there were their yarns. I hardly knew nor cared which were true and which were not. Tales of castaways on Pacific atolls never failed to move me. Solemn accounts of angels and ghosts appearing miraculously in the rigging were, by turns, thrilling and terrifying. I learned the men's language, their ways, their dreams. Above all, I cherished the notion that my contact with the crew improved them. As to what it did to me, I hardly guessed. At first standoffish and suspicious, the crew began to accept me. I actually became something of a ship's boy, increasingly willing and able to run their minor errands. Of course, there were places on the Seahawk where I did not venture. Though I returned several times to my trunk and was not frightened again, I forbore exploring the hold. Barlow's words and my experience were sufficient to scare me off. The other place I shunned was the crew's quarters, the forecastle area before the mast. That I understood to be off limits. But as I grew more comfortable, as the crew grew more comfortable with me, I mingled more often with them on deck. In time, I even tried my hand and climbed, granted neither very high nor very far, into the rigging. As might be expected, I fastened particular attentions upon Zachariah. He had the most time to spend with me, and had sought to be kind, of course, from the beginning. Being black, he was the butt of much cruel humor, which aroused my sympathy. At the same time, despite the crew's verbal abuse, he was a great favorite, reputed to be a fine cook. Indeed, his good opinion of me gained me, in the crew's world, the license to be liked. Zachariah was the eldest of the crew, and his life had been naught but sailing. When young, he had shipped as a common sailor, and he swore he'd been able to climb from deck to truck, top of the mainmast, in 20 seconds. But all in all, as he himself freely told me, he was much the worse for his labor, and therefore grateful for his cook's position, which had paid better than a common tar. For he was aging rapidly, and though he claimed no more than 50 years of age, I thought him much older. He had saved nothing of his wages. His knowledge, as far as I could tell, was limited to ship and sea. He knew not how to read, nor to write more than his mark. He knew little of true Christian religion. Indeed, as he confessed, he was much distressed as to the state of his soul, and took comfort, as did others, in my reading aloud from the Bible, which they believed had the power to compel truth. In particular, it was the story of Jonah that had a hold on them. Since Zachariah never mentioned the dirk, nor again spoke discourteously of the captain, I took it as an indication that he knew I would not condone such talk. This meant that our conversations were increasingly free and easy. It was he, more than anyone else, who encouraged me to engage with the crew.
"Miss Doyle has been kind to me," he said to me one morning. "But if she's to go scampering about, she'll need, for modesty and safety's sake, something better than skirts."
So saying, he presented me with a pair of canvas trousers and blouse, a kind of miniature of what the crew wore, garments he himself had made. While I thanked him kindly, in fact, I took the gift as a warning that I had been forgetting my station. I told him, rather stiffly, I fear, that I thought it not proper for me, a girl, a lady, to wear such apparel. But, so as not to offend too deeply, I took the blouse and trousers to my cabin. Later on, I admit, I tried the garments on, finding them surprisingly comfortable until, shocked, I remembered myself. Hurriedly I took them off, resolving not to stoop so low again. I resolved more. I determined to keep to my quarters, and then and there spent 2 hours composing an essay in my blank book on the subject of proper behavior for young women. When I emerged for tea with Captain Jaggery, I begged permission to read him some of what I had written. So unstinting was he in his praise that I gained a double pleasure, for in his commendation I was certain I had won my father's approval too, so much were their characters alike. The captain spent his days in punctilious attention to the ship, pacing off the quarter-deck from wheel to rail, from rail to wheel, ever alert to some disorder to correct. If his eyes were not upon the sails, they were upon the ropes and spars. If not upon those, they rested on the decking. It was just as he had warned me. The crew was prone to laxness. But, since he had the responsibility of the ship, not they, he was forced, with constant surveillance and commands, to bring discipline to their work. Things I never would have thought important, he could find at grievous fault. From tarnish upon a rail, to limp sails and ragged spars, whether it was rigging to be overhauled, or new tar to be applied, blocks, tackle, shrouds, each and all were forever in want of repair. Decks had to be holystoned, caulked, and scrubbed anew. The bow scraped and scraped again, the figurehead repainted. In short, under his keen eye, everything was kept in perfect order. For this, all hands would be called sometimes, more than twice a watch. I heard the calls even at night. Indeed, so mindful was the captain's sense of responsibility toward the ship, my father's firm, as he was wont to remind me, that no man on watch was ever allowed to do nothing, but was kept at work. "You are not paid to be idle," the captain often declared, and he, setting an example, was never slack in his duty. Even at our teas he was vigilant, again so like my father, and patiently examined me as to what I had seen, heard, or even thought, always ready with quick and wise correction. He was not so patient with the first and second mates, to whom he gave all his orders, depending upon whose watch it was. These men, Mr. Hollybrass and Mr. Keech, were as different from the captain as from each other. Mr. Keech, when summoned, would scuttle quickly to his side, nervous, agitated, that look of fear forever about him, and absorb the captain's barked orders with a cringing servility. Mr. Hollybrass, the first mate, would approach slowly, seeming to take his own silent soundings about the captain's demands. He might lift his shaggy eyebrows as if to object, but I never heard him actually contradict the captain in words. Indeed, the captain would only repeat his commands, and then Mr. Hollybrass would obey.
"Have Mr. Dillingham redo the futtock shrouds," he'd say. Or, "Get Mr. Foley to set the fore gaff topsail proper." Or again, "Have Mr. Morgan set that main clew garnet to rights."
The men of the crew, hardly finished with one task, would have to set about another, though they did so with dark looks and not so silent oaths. The captain, gentleman that he was, appeared to take no notice. But more than once I watched him call upon Mr. Hollybrass, or less often Mr. Keech, to punish a man for some slackness or slowness I could not detect. If provoked sufficiently, the captain might resort to a push or a slap with his own open hand. And, much to my surprise, I saw him strike Morgan, a short, stocky, squinty-eyed monkey of a man, with a belaying pin, one of the heavy wood dowels used to secure a rigging rope to the pin-rail. In dismay, I averted my eyes. The fellow was tardy about reefing a sail, the captain said, and went on to catalogue further likely threats. Confinement in the brig, salary docking, no meals, lashings, duckings in the cold sea, or even keel-hauling, which, as I learned, meant pulling a man from one side of the ship to the other, under water. "Miss Doyle," he might say when we took our daily tea, "you see them for yourself. Are they not the dirtiest, laziest dogs?"
"Yes, sir,"
I'd reply softly, though I felt increasingly uncomfortable because I could sense resentment growing among the crew.
And was ever a Christian more provoked than I?
No, sir.
Now, he would always ask, what have you observed?
Dutifully, I would report everything I'd seen and heard, the dodges from work, the clenched fists, the muttered oaths of defiance that I had tried hard not to hear. When I'd done, he always said the same.
Before we hove home, Miss Doyle, I shall break them to my will, each and every one.
One afternoon the wind ceased, and for days after the Seahawk was becalmed. It was like nothing I'd ever experienced. Not only did the breeze vanish and the heat rise, but the sea lay like something dead. Air became thick, positively wringing wet, searing to the lungs. Fleas and roaches seemed to crawl out from every timber. The ship, festering in her own malodorous breath, moaned and groaned. 5 times during those days, Captain Jaggery ordered the jollyboats lowered. With Mr. Hollybrass in command of one, Mr. Keach the other, they towed the Seahawk in search of wind. It was useless. No wind was to be found. Then the captain, abruptly accepting the ship's windless fate, set the men to work harder than ever, as though the doldrums had been prearranged in order that he might refit and burnish the Seahawk as though new made.
Sweet are the uses of adversity, he instructed me.
The complaints of the crew grew louder. The oaths became, by perceptible degrees, darker yet. When I reported all this to the captain, he frowned and shook his head.
No one ranks for creative genius like a sailor shirking work.
The crew is tired, I murmured, trying to suggest in a hesitant, vague way that even I could see that the men were fatigued and in need of rest.
Miss Doyle, he said with a sudden, hard laugh, even while urging a second sweet biscuit upon me, you have my word. They shall wake up when we run into storm.
How right he was. But the storm was, at first, man-made. Chapter 9. For 3 more days we drifted upon the glassy sea. The helplessness of it, I could tell, drove Captain Jaggery nearly to distraction. Though the sun grew fiercer, he kept sending the men out in jollyboats to tow the Seahawk for 2 hours at a time in search of wind. He found only more to complain about. And then it happened. It was late afternoon, 18 days into our voyage, the first dog watch. I was on the forecastle deck with Ewing. Ewing was a young blonde Scot, handsome, I thought, with a shocking tattoo of a mermaid upon his arm. That and his Aberdeen sweetheart, about whom he loved to talk, fascinated me. I rather fancied sweetheart and mermaid were one. At the time, he was sitting cross-legged, quite exhausted. That morning, the captain had ordered him to spend the day in the highest reaches of the yards, putting new tar on the stays. The sun was brutal. The tar was sticky. Now an old canvas jacket lay in his lap, and with trembling fingers he was attempting to patch it, using needle and all. While he labored, I read to him from one of my favorite books, Blind Barbara Ann, A Tale of Loving Poverty. He was listening intently when his needle snapped in two. He swore, hastily apologized for cursing in my presence, then cast about for a new needle. When he couldn't find one, he murmured something about having to get another from his box in the forecastle, and made to heave himself up. Knowing how tired he was, I asked, "Can I get it for you?" "It would be a particular kindness, Miss Doyle," he answered. "My legs being terrible stiff today." "Where should I look?" I asked. "Beneath my hammock, in the topmost part of my chest," he said, "in the forecastle." "Will someone be able to point it out?"
"I should think so," he said. Without much thought, other than that I wished to do the man a kindness, I turned and hurried away.
I had scampered down the forecastle entryway before pausing to think. The forecastle was one of the few areas I had not been in before, the one place on the Seahawk that the sailors called their own. Not even Captain Jaggery ventured there. No one had ever said I was not to go, but I assumed I would not be welcome. With this reservation in mind, I hurried to the galley in hopes of finding Zachariah. I would ask him to fetch the needle. The galley, however, was deserted. Since I did not wish to disappoint Ewing, I decided I must go and fetch the needle myself. Timidly, I approached the forecastle door. As I did, I heard muted voices from within. Indeed, it was only because they were vague and indistinct that I found myself straining to listen. And what I heard was this.
"I say I'll be the one to give the word, and none other. It had better be soon. Jaggery's pushing us hard. How many names do we have? There's 7 that's put down their mark, but there's others inclined.
What about Johnson?
It doesn't look right. He's not got the spirit. It won't do. He needs to be with us or not. No halfway. And I don't like that girl always spying. Her being here isn't anyone's fault. We tried. You remind yourself we kept those other passengers off."
I heard these words, spoken by at least 4 voices, but I did not at the moment fully grasp their meaning. Understanding would come later. Instead, I was caught up in embarrassment that I should be eavesdropping where I hardly belonged. It was not a very ladylike thing to do. Yet I was, in part, the subject of their conversation. And the errand was still to be done. Wanting to do what I'd promised, I knocked upon the door. Sudden silence. Then,
"Who's there?"
"Miss Doyle, please." Another pause.
"What do you want?"
came a demand. "It's for Mr. Ewing," I returned. "He sent me for a needle." There was some muttering, swearing. Then,
"All right. A moment."
I heard rustling, the sound of people moving. Then the door was pushed open. Fisk looked out. He was a very large man, lantern-jawed, his fists clenched more often than not, as though perpetually prepared to brawl.
"What do you say?" he demanded.
"Mr. Ewing wants a needle from his chest," I said meekly. He glowered.
"Come along, then,"
he said, waving me in. I stepped forward and looked about. The only light came from the open door, just enough for me to see that the low ceiling was festooned with dirty garments. I was accosted by a heavy stench of sweat and filth. Scraps of cheap pictures, some of a scandalous nature, were nailed here and there to the walls in aimless fashion. Cups, shoes, belaying pins, all lay jumbled in heaps. In the center of the floor was a trunk on which sat a crude checkerboard, itself partly covered with a sheet of paper. Along the walls hammocks were slung, but so low I could not see the faces of those in them. What I did see were the arms and legs of 3 men. They seemed to be asleep, though I knew that could not be true. I had heard more than one voice.
"Mr. Ewing's chest is there,"
Fisk said, gesturing to a corner with a thumb. He lumbered back to his hammock, sat in it, and, though he said no more, watched me suspiciously. The small wooden chest was tucked under one of the empty hammocks. Apprehensively, I knelt, briefly turning to Fisk to make sure that this chest was indeed Ewing's. He grunted an affirmation. Then I turned back, drew the small trunk forward, and flipped open the top. The first thing that met my eyes was a pistol. The sight of it was so startling that all I could do was stare. One thought filled my mind. Captain Jaggery had told me, bragged to me, that there were no firearms anywhere on board but in his cabinet. My eyes shifted. I saw a piece of cork into which some needles were stuck. I pulled one out and hastily shut the chest in hopes that no one else had seen what I had. Then I came to my feet and turned to leave. Fisk was looking hard at me. I forced myself to return his gaze, hoping I was not revealing anything of my feelings. Then I started out, but in my haste stumbled into the trunk in the center of the area. The sheet of paper fluttered to the floor. Apologetic, I stooped to gather it, and in a glance saw that on the paper two circles had been drawn, one inside the other, and there appeared to be names and marks written between the lines. The instant I saw it, I knew what it was. A round robin. Clumsily, I pushed the paper away, murmured a thank you, then fled. I was trembling when I left the forecastle. To make matters worse, the first person I saw was the second mate, Mr. Keach, who was passing on his way to the galley. I stopped short, with what was, no doubt, a guilty cast to my face. Fortunately, he paid no attention to me, giving me hardly a look beyond his normal nervous frown. Then he continued on. But though he was gone, I simply stood there, not knowing what to think or do. Unconsciously, I clasped my hand, jabbing my palm with the needle. Ever faithful to my sense of duty, even in that moment of crisis, I hurried to Ewing and gave the needle to him. "Here, miss," he said, scrutinizing my face as he took it. "Have you taken ill?"
"No, thank you," I whispered, attempting to avoid his look. "I am fine." I fled hastily back to my cabin and secured the door behind me. Once alone, I climbed atop my bed and flung myself down, then gave myself over entirely to the question of what I should do. You will understand that there was no doubt in my mind regarding what I had seen. There had been a pistol. There had been a round robin. With the warnings given to me by Captain Jaggery, and ever mindful of the possibilities revealed to me by Zachariah, I had little doubt about the meaning of my discoveries. The crew was preparing a rebellion. Regaining some degree of calmness, I thought over who it was that had been in the forecastle. To begin with, there was Fisk. He was part of Mr. Keach's watch, so it was reasonable to assume that the other members of his watch were with him. There were, I knew, four men in that watch. Ewing, Morgan, Foley, and, of course, Fisk himself. But as I reviewed these names, my feelings of puzzlement grew. What I had observed did not make sense. Then I grasped it. I had seen Fisk. It was he who had opened the forecastle door, and Ewing was on the forecastle deck. But when I stepped inside, there had been three hammocks occupied with men. In short, I had seen a total of five men off watch. Assuming the other hammocks indeed held members of the watch, who then was the fifth man? Could it have been Mr. Keach himself? No. I had seen him just outside the forecastle when I emerged. Nor could it have been someone who was on duty. The captain would never have tolerated that. Who, then, was that fifth man? I began to wonder if I'd not been mistaken about the number, reminding myself that a hammock full of clothing would have looked much the same as one occupied by a man. But the more I recollected what I'd seen, the weight of the hammocks, the dangling arms and legs, the more convinced I grew that I'd indeed seen four men. Suddenly, like the crack of a wind-whipped sail, I recalled my dim vision when waiting to board the Seahawk the night of my arrival, of a man hauling himself up ropes to the ship. Of course! A stowaway! But where could such a man have hidden himself? No sooner did I ask myself that than I remembered the face which had so frightened me in the top cargo when I'd gone for my clothing. It had been a face that I'd not recognized. Indeed, it was just that lack of recognition that convinced me I'd imagined it. In fact, I now realized, I must have seen the stowaway. No wonder I did not recognize him. He had been hiding in the hold, which explained Barlow's dire words about the place, as well as the grinning carving. The man sought to scare me from the place. But having arrived at that conclusion, I asked myself this. What was I to do with my discovery? To ask the question was to have the answer. Captain Jaggery. It was to him I owed my allegiance, by custom, by habit, by law. To him I must speak. And the truth was, in addition to everything else, I was now consumed by guilt and terror that I had not told him before of the incident in the top cargo. So it was that by the time I had come full course in my thinking, I knew I mustn't wait a moment longer. I needed to get to Captain Jaggery. Recollecting the time, 3 bells of the second dog watch, I knew that the captain would most likely be found by the helm. Nervously, I emerged from my cabin and went on to the deck in search of him. The first man I saw was Morgan, leaning against the starboard rail. He was a gangly, long-limbed, muscular fellow, with a fierce mustache and long hair. As he was one of Mr. Keach's watch, not currently on duty, he should have been among those in a forecastle hammock when I'd been there. I say he should have been, because I'd not seen his face. His presence was only a surmise. But there he was, on deck. Brought to a dead stop, I gazed dumbly at him. He, in return, gazed right at me. Surely, I thought, he was there to observe me. For that long moment we stood looking at one another. I saw no emotion on his face. But what he did next left me with little doubt as to his real intentions. He lifted a hand, extended a stiletto-like forefinger, and drew it across his own neck as if cutting it. A spasm of horror shot through me. He was, in the crudest way, warning me about what might happen to me if I took my discovery to the captain. For a moment more, I remained rooted to the spot. Then I turned to lean upon the portside topgallant rail and stared out over the ocean, trying to recover my breath. When I had sufficiently steadied my nerves, I turned back cautiously. Morgan was gone. But he had achieved his purpose. I was twice as frightened as I'd been when first I stepped upon the Seahawk. Anxiously, I glanced about to see if I was being watched by anyone else. Sure enough, now it was Foley whom I spied atop the forecastle. He was busily splicing a rope. At least, that's what he seemed to be doing. The instant I saw him, he looked up and pinioned me with a gaze of blatant scrutiny. Then, quickly, he shifted his eyes away. He, too, was spying on me. Completely unnerved, I retreated to my cabin and bolted the door. The warnings had an effect quite opposite to what was doubtless intended. More terrified than ever, I now felt that the only person who could help me was Captain Jaggery. But so fearful was I of going on deck in search of him, I decided to wait in his cabin till he returned, certain that the crew would not dare to pursue me there. Cautiously, I pulled the door open again, poked my head out, and when I saw, to my relief, no one was nearby, I rushed to the captain's door, and out of a habit of politeness, knocked. To my indescribable relief, I heard, "Come in." I flung the door open. Captain Jaggery was looking over some charts. Mr. Hollybrass was at his side. The captain turned about. "Miss Doyle?" he said politely. "Is there something I can do for you?" "Please, sir. I was finding it difficult to breathe. I should like a private word." He looked at me quizzically. I had not come to him in agitation before.
"Is it important?"
"I think so, sir. And perhaps it can wait until—" No doubt it was the distraught expression on my face. He changed his mind. "Come in and shut the door," he said, his manner becoming alert. Mr. Hollybrass made a move to go. The captain reached out to restrain him.
"Do you have any objections to Mr. Hollybrass being here?"
he asked. "I don't know, sir."
"Very well, he shall stay. There's no one I trust more. Now then, Miss Doyle, step forward and say what's troubling you."
I nodded, but could only gulp like a fish out of water. "Miss Doyle, if you have something of importance to tell me, speak it." I lifted my eyes. The captain was studying me with great intensity. In a flash, I recollected a time when my much-loved brother broke a rare vase, and I, out of a high sense of duty, told on him, despite what I knew would be my father's certain fury. "I was fetching a needle for Mr. Ewing," I got out. "A needle," he returned, somewhat deflated. Then he asked, "Where did you find it?"
"In the forecastle."
"The forecastle?" he echoed, trying to prime my tongue. "Is it your habit to frequent that place, Miss Doyle?"
"Never before, sir."
"What happened when you went there?"
I saw a pistol."
"Did you?"
I nodded.
"Where exactly?"
I glanced around. Mr. Hollybrass's normally red face had gone to the pallor of wet salt, whereas the captain was suddenly flushed with excitement. "Must I say, sir?"
"Of course you must, Miss Doyle. Where did you see the pistol?"
"In Mr. Ewing's chest, sir."
"Mr. Ewing's chest," the captain repeated, exchanging a glance with the first mate as if to affirm something. Then the captain turned back to me. "Anything else?"
I bit my lip.
"There is more, isn't there?" he said.
"Yes, sir."
"Out with it."
"I saw a..." I could not speak.
"A what, Miss Doyle?"
"A round robin."
Now it was the captain who gasped. "A round robin?" he exclaimed. "Are you quite sure?"
"Just as you showed me, sir. I'm certain of it."
"Describe it."
"I did."
"And there were names written in, were there?"
"And marks, yes, sir."
"How many?"
"I'm not certain. Perhaps 5, 6.
"Six!" the captain shouted with a darting glance at Mr. Hollybrass. "I wonder it's not 9. Could you see whose names they were?"
"No, sir."
"I'm not certain I believe you," he snapped. "It's true," I cried. And to prove my honesty, I hurriedly gave him an account of my experiences in the top cargo, as well as my conclusion that the ship carried a stowaway. By the time I was done, he was seething. "Why the devil did you not tell me before?" he demanded.
"I didn't trust my own senses, sir."
"After all I have done for..."
He failed to finish the sentence.
Instead, he growled, "So be it," and said no more before turning from me and pacing away, leaving both Mr. Hollybrass and me to watch. "Mr. Hollybrass," he said finally. "Sir?" "Call all hands." "Sir, what do you intend to do?" "I intend to crush this mutiny before it starts."
Chapter 10. Captain Jaggery strode across the room and from the wall removed the portrait of his daughter. Affixed to its back was a key. With this, he unlocked the gun safe, and in a moment he and Mr. Hollybrass were by the door, ready. The captain held 2 muskets and had 2 pistols tucked into his belt. Mr. Hollybrass was similarly armed. Terrified by the response my words had caused, I simply stood where I'd been. The captain would have none of that.
"Miss Doyle, you're to come with us."
"But..."
"Do as I tell you," he shouted. "There's no time for delay."
He flung one of his muskets to Mr. Hollybrass, who miraculously caught it, then grabbed me by an arm and pulled me after him. We ran out along the steerage into the waist of the ship, then quickly mounted to the quarterdeck. Only then did the captain let me go. He now grasped the bell clapper and began to pull wildly, as though announcing a fire, while shouting,
"All hands! All hands!"
That done, he held his hand out to Mr. Hollybrass, who returned the extra musket to him. I looked about, not knowing what to expect,
save that I truly feared for my life. Then I realized that the ship appeared to be completely unmanned. Not a sailor was to be seen anywhere, aloft or on deck. The sails hung like dead cloth. The wheel was abandoned. The rigging rattled with eerie irrelevance. The Seahawk was adrift. The first person to appear below us was Mr. Keach. Within seconds of the bell sounding, he came bolting from below, took one look at the captain and Mr. Hollabrass, armed above him, and stopped short, then turned as if expecting to see others. He was alone.
"Mr. Keach," the captain cried out to him, "where do you stand?"
The second mate turned back to the captain, a look of panicky confusion upon his face. But before he could respond or act on the captain's question, the rest of the crew burst from beneath the forecastle deck with wild, blood-curdling yells. The crew's first appearance was fierce enough, though almost grotesquely comical, the nine of them looking like so many beggars. When I'd seen them on the day we went to sea, they seemed unkempt. Now they looked destitute, their clothing torn and dirty, their faces unshaved, their expressions contorted with fear and fury. Of the nine, only Zachariah was not armed. The rest were. Some carried pistols. I recall two having swords. Dillingham had an ancient cutlass in hand, Barlow a knife. Hardly had they flown out upon the deck than they perceived the captain standing on the quarter-deck, one musket pointing directly at them, the other leaning against the rail within easy reach. They stopped, frozen. If they had rushed forward, they might have overwhelmed the three of us. But it was now Captain Jaggery and the muskets that held them in check. With a start, I realized there was a tenth man standing below us. He was muscular and stocky, with a red kerchief tied around his neck and a sword in his hand. As I looked at him in astonishment, I saw that he had but one arm. I recalled Zachariah's tale of the sailor the captain had so severely punished, the man whose arm was so beaten it had to be amputated. Standing before us was Cranach himself. It was his face I had seen in the top cargo, the stowaway. I gasped. Captain Jaggery stepped swiftly to the rail and spoke.
"Ah, it is Mr. Cranach," he said boldly,
holding his musket aimed directly at the man's burly chest.
"I wondered where you'd gone. Not to hell, as I'd hoped, but here. May I," he went on with heavy sarcasm, "be the last to welcome you aboard the Seahawk."
The man took a shuffled step forward. He was clearly the crew's leader.
"Mr. Jaggery," he began, pointedly declining to say captain. "I said we would be revenged upon you, did I not?"
"I heard your usual brag, Mr. Cranach, if that's what you mean," the captain replied, "but I paid no more mind to it then than I do now."
At that, Cranach lifted his one hand and, still managing to hold the sword, savagely pulled a paper from where it had been tucked into his trousers. He held the paper up.
"Mr. Jaggery," he called, his voice ragged, "we've got a round robin here, which declares you unfit to be captain of the Seahawk."
There were murmurs of agreement from behind him.
"And what do you intend to do with it, Mr. Cranach?" the captain retorted. "I should think even you, in your mongrel ignorance, would know the days of piracy are long gone. Or do you have that much desire to bring back the practice of hanging in chains, of letting men rot so that crows might peck upon their putrid eyes?" "No piracy for us, Mr. Jaggery," Cranach replied with a vigorous shake of his head. "Only justice. We could not get it on land. We shall have it at sea." "Justice, say you? Under whose authority?" the captain demanded.
"All of us. Our authority,"
Cranach cried, and made a half turn to the men behind him. There were murmurs and nods of approval.
"And what kind of justice do you offer?"
the captain asked.
"Nothing precisely legal, I presume." "We demand you stand before us in a trial of your peers,"
Cranach answered.
"Trial, peers," the captain cried mockingly. "I see nothing but ruffians and villains, the scum of the sea." "Then we proclaim ourselves your peers," Krannic cried.
With that, he flung down the paper and took another step forward.
"You can have anyone you want defend you," he persisted. "Have that girl, if you like. She seems to be your eyes and ears. Let her be your mouth, too."
It was at that exact moment that Captain Jaggery fired his musket. The roar was stupendous. The ball struck Krannic square in the chest. With a cry of pain and mortal shock, he dropped his sword and stumbled backward into the crowd. They were too stunned to catch him, but instead leaped back so that Krannic fell to the deck with a sickening thud. He began to groan and thrash about in dreadful agony, blood pulsing from his chest and mouth in ghastly gushes. I screamed. Mr. Hollabrass moaned. In horror, the crew retreated further. Captain Jaggery hastily dropped his spent musket, picked up the second, and aimed it into their midst.
"Who shall be next?"
he screamed at them. To a man, they looked up with burning, terrified eyes.
"Let Krannic lie there,"
the captain continued to shout.
"Anyone who moves forward shall receive the same."
The crew began to edge further away.
"Leave your guns and swords," the captain shouted. "Quickly now. I'll fire upon the first who doesn't."
Pistols, swords, and knives dropped in a clatter.
"Mr. Hollabrass, collect them."
The first mate scurried down the steps and, while glancing upward, began to gather the weapons. It was clear he feared the captain more than the crew.
"They're round robin, too,"
the captain called to him. Too shocked to speak, I could only watch and feel enormous pain. Krannic had stopped moving. The only sign of life in him were the small pink bubbles of blood that frothed upon his lips. It was then that I saw Zachariah slip from the frozen tableau and move toward the fallen man. He held his hands before him, waist high, palms up, as if to prove he carried no weapons. He kept his eyes on the captain.
"Let him be, Mr. Zachariah," the captain barked. "He's a stowaway. He has no claim to any care."
The old man paused.
"As a man," he said in a voice wonderfully calm midst the chaos, "he claims our mercy."
The captain lifted his musket.
"No,"
he said firmly. Zachariah looked at him, then at Krannic. I may have imagined it, but I believe he may even have looked at me. In any case, he continued on with slow, deliberate steps toward the fallen man. I watched, terrified but fascinated, certain that the angry captain would shoot. I saw his finger on the trigger tighten, but then he relaxed. Zachariah knelt by Krannic and put his hand to the man's wrist. He let it fall.
"Mr. Krannic is no more," he announced.
The stillness that followed these words was broken only by the soft, sudden flutter of a sail, the tinkling toll of a chain.
"Get him over," the captain said finally.
No one moved.
"Mr. Zachariah,"
the captain repeated with impatience.
"Get him over."
Once again, Zachariah held out his open hands.
"Begging the captain's pardon," he said, "even a poor sinner such as he should have his Christian service." "Mr. Hollabrass," the captain barked.
The first mate, having unloaded the crew's pistols, had returned to the quarterdeck.
"Sir,"
he said,
"I want that dog's carcass thrown over."
"Cannot Mr. Zachariah say a few words?"
"Mr. Hollabrass, do as you're ordered."
The man looked from the captain to the crew.
"Aye, aye, sir," he said softly.
Then slowly, as if a great weight had been cast upon him, he descended to the deck. Taking hold of the fallen man by his one arm, he began to drag him toward the rail. In his wake, he left a trail of blood.
"Mr. Zachariah,"
the captain thundered,
"open the gate."
Zachariah gazed at the captain. Slowly, he shook his head. For a moment, the two merely looked at one another. Then the captain turned to me.
Miss Doyle, open the gate.
I stared at him in shocked disbelief.
Miss Doyle!
He now screamed in a livid rage. Sir, I stammered.
Open the gate.
I can't. Abruptly, the captain himself marched down the steps, pistols in hand. When he approached the railing, he tucked one gun under his arm and quickly unlatched the gate so that it stood gaping above the sea.
Mr. Hollybrass,
he snapped. Mr. Hollybrass, sweat running down his hot red face, pulled the body close, but then he paused and offered a look of appeal to Captain Jaggery. The captain spat at Cranick's body.
Over,
he insisted. The first mate pushed the body through the gate opening. There was a splash. My stomach turned. I saw some of the sailors wince. The captain spoke again.
Mr. Cranick was not a part of this ship, he said. His coming and going have nothing to do with us. They shall not even be entered in the log. Beyond all that, you should know you are a very poor set of curs. It took only this girl, he nodded up to me, to unmask you.
Sullen eyes turned toward me. Ashamed, I looked away, trying to stifle my tears.
As for the rest, the captain continued, I ask only that one of you, your second in command, if you have one, come forward and take his punishment. Then the voyage shall go on as before. Who shall it be?
When no one spoke, the captain turned to me.
Miss Doyle, as our lady, I'll give you the privilege. Which one of these men shall you choose?
I gazed at him in horrified astonishment.
Yes, you. Since it was you who uncovered this despicable plot, I give you the honor of ending it. Whom shall you pick to set an example?
I could only shake my head.
Come, come, not so shy. You must have some favorite.
Please, sir, I whispered. I gazed down on the crew, looking now like so many broken animals. I don't want...
If you are too soft, I shall choose.
Captain Jaggery, I attempted to plead. He contemplated the men. Then he said,
Mr. Zachariah, step forward.
Chapter 11. Zachariah did not so much step forward as those about him shrank away. He stood there alone, as if he'd been marooned upon a Pacific isle. Though he did not lift his eyes, he seemed nonetheless to sense his abandonment. Small, wrinkled man that he was, he appeared to have grown smaller.
Mr. Zachariah, the captain said, do you have anything to say?
Zachariah remained silent.
You had best speak for yourself, the captain taunted. I doubt your friends will say a word in your defense. They are all cowards.
He paused as if waiting for someone to challenge him. When no one spoke, he nodded and said,
So much for your shipmates, Mr. Zachariah. So much for your round robin. Now, sir, I ask you again, have you anything to say on your own behalf?
At first, Zachariah stared dead ahead. Then he shifted his gaze slightly. I was certain he was looking right at me now. I tried to turn away, but couldn't. Instead, I stood gazing at him, eyes flooded with tears. Zachariah began to speak.
I have been a sailor for more than 40 years, he said slowly. There have been hard captains and easy ones. But you, sir, have been the worst. No, I'll not regret rising against you,
he continued in his halting way.
I can only wish I'd acted sooner. I forgive the girl. You used her. She did not know better. I forgive my mates, too. They know where Captain Jaggery takes command. Know
God signs on.
A pretty speech, the captain said scornfully. And as much a confession as anything I've ever heard. You may all note it, in case anyone bothers to ask questions. Though I shouldn't think anyone will care.
He looked contemptuously over the rest of the crew.
Is there any jack among you that will second this black man's slanders?
No one spoke.
Come now, he baited them. Who will be bold enough to say that Captain Andrew Jaggery is the worst master he's ever served? Speak up. I'll double the pay of the man who says yea.
Though the glitter of hatred in their eyes was palpable enough, no one dared give voice to it. The captain had them that much cowed.
Very well, he said. Mr. Hollabrass, string Mr. Zachariah up.
The first mate hesitated.
Mr. Hollabrass.
Aye, aye, sir, the man mumbled. With a kind of shuffle, he approached Zachariah, but then stood before the old man as if nerving himself. Finally, he reached out. Zachariah stepped back, but it was of no avail. The first mate caught him by the arm and led him back up the steps.
As I looked on, aware only that something terrible was about to happen, Mr. Hollybrass set Zachariah against the outer rail and stripped him of his jacket. The skin of the old man's chest hung loose and wrinkled like a ragged burlap bag. Mr. Hollybrass turned Zachariah so that he faced into the shrouds, then climbed up into these shrouds and with a piece of rope bound his hands, pulling him so that the old man was all but hanging from his wrists, just supporting himself on the tips of his bare toes. Zachariah uttered no sound. I turned to look at Captain Jaggery. Only then did I see that he had a whip in his hands, its four strands twitching like the tail of an angry cat. Where he got it, I don't know. Feeling ill, I made to leave the deck.
Miss Doyle,
the captain cried out.
You will remain.
I stopped dead.
You are needed as witness, he informed me.
Now the captain held the whip out to his first mate.
Mr. Hollybrass, he said, he's to have 50 lashes.
Again Hollybrass hesitated, eyebrows arched in question.
Captain, he said, 50 lashes seem... 50,
the captain insisted.
Start.
Hollybrass grasped the whip. As he took his time squaring away behind Zachariah, I could see his hand flex nervously, his temples pulse.
Quickly,
the captain demanded. Hollybrass lifted his arm and cocked it. Once more he paused, took a deep breath, until, with what appeared to be the merest flick of his wrist, the whip shot forward. Its tails hissed through the air and spat against Zachariah's back. The moment they touched the old man's skin, four red welts appeared. I felt I would faint.
With strength, Mr. Hollybrass,
the captain urged.
With strength!
Hollybrass cocked his arm. Again the wrist twisted. The whip struck. Zachariah's body gave a jerk. Four new red welt lines crossed the first. Captain Jaggery, I cried out suddenly, as much surprised as anyone that I was doing so. The captain, startled, turned to look at me. Please, sir, I pleaded. You mustn't. For a moment the captain said nothing. His face had become very white.
Why mustn't I? He asked.
It's not fair, I stammered.
Fair,
he echoed, his voice thick with derision.
Fair? These men meant to murder me, and no doubt you, Miss Doyle. And you talk of fair. If it's fairness you want, I could quote you chapter and line of the Admiralty Codes that say I'd serve justice best by shooting the cur.
Please, sir, I said, tears running down my cheeks. I shouldn't have told you. I didn't know. I'm sure Mr. Zachariah meant no harm. I'm sure he didn't.
No harm, Miss Doyle.
The captain held up the round robin.
Surely they teach you better logic than that in school.
But I had no idea that...
Of course you had an idea,
the captain snapped, his voice rising so all could hear.
You came to me in shock and terror to inform me about what you'd seen. How right you were to do so. And right is what we do here. Proper order will be maintained.
He swung about.
Mr. Hollybrass, you have given but 2 lashes. If you can do no better, you'd best stand